Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. On many occasions over the years, I've heard whites talking about our current situation being hopeless, impossible, can't achieve anything, we stand no chance, we're all gonna die. I've heard this from people in other countries, and I've heard it from whites here in South Africa. And the whites turn around and they say, everything is hopeless, we're totally screwed, there's just no chance at all, we're finished. Therefore, in a nutshell, we are basically dead men walking, we just haven't fallen over yet. We haven't fallen down dead yet, but we should be dead because our situation is so hopeless. The truth of the matter, however, is that the shopping mall and capitalism has weakened us. We've spent so much time in the shopping mall and we've worked so hard for capitalism and chasing money that there are other skills that our ancestors had that we've forgotten about, and these skills have become atrophied, and we've forgotten what we are capable of doing, actually. Hitler said something along the lines that we need a war every 25 years because otherwise we'd become too soft. Well, we've gone for decades without any major conflicts, and we've become so pathetic, and being surrounded by capitalists and Jews, our minds have rotted, and we've forgotten what we are capable of, and we've forgotten the kinds of things that our ancestors and other Europeans have lived through. If our ancient ancestors had to see us nowadays and listen to us complaining, I think they would be astounded. They would be shocked if they saw the awesomeness of our science and technology, and then they would have to hear us complaining that we're screwed, because the kinds of things that they faced with much, much less technology and which they overcame, it would amaze them. I think they'd be stunned to see people who can fly through the air, go into outer space, go under the sea to tremendous depths, and all the insane things that we can do, and then we turn around and we look at life and we say, we're so screwed. Because they wouldn't be able to understand how it is that people who can do so much and who have so much truly magical and insane stuff at their fingertips, that we could actually turn around and say, you know, we can fly through the sky anytime we want, but guess what? We can't control a couple of blacks who are running around with rocks and sticks and knives and a couple of guns. They will not be able to understand that there are things that scare us when we have so much at our fingertips and we've done so much. How can people who can fly through the air or go under the water, or who can race across land in cars, race across water in ships, and then we turn around and we see a couple of blacks, and those blacks are jumping around in the idiotic way that they're jumping around, and those blacks are coming with knives and guns, and then we say, oh God, no, We're screwed, man. We're screwed. They won't understand that because even they, with their weapons of their time, would probably have been willing to face off against blacks. For example, our ancestors, tens of thousands of years ago, were busy hunting mammoths. They were hunting mammoths. There are places where they even used to engage in what you could call mammoth genocide, where they would herd mammoths and chase them off cliff edges. I think in Spain they found such a place. And when they couldn't kill the mammoths that easily, they would still take on the mammoths while using nothing more than wooden spears. So here are men, white men, facing these enormous animals that are like twice the size of an African elephant. And we could engage in teamwork to kill such an animal, such an animal that can come and run us down. And yet our ancestors did that, and they took those risks. And here we are, we're capable of flying through the sky faster than the speed of sound. And now we are too afraid to face something that is not even a fraction as dangerous as a mammoth. Or one of the many other creatures that our ancestors faced, because there were all kinds of big, dangerous creatures around. Even in the forests of Germany, there were pigs, sort of hogs that were big and that used to run around. And the Germans used to actually be very proud when any German could kill one of these animals because they were so dangerous. And he would have to do it without using a rifle or anything like that. So I think that if our ancestors had to see us today, and hear our cries of help. Oh, help us, help us. We're so screwed because we are facing the Black Plague and all these other non-white plagues, and we've got a couple of Jews that are around. That if we had to cry out and say, help us, we're so screwed. Our ancestors just wouldn't know what to make of this absolute uselessness. They wouldn't believe that their offspring, many generations later, can be freaked out by that. Of course, I do understand why people think in those terms, and it's because we do know that we're all ruled by a hostile elite, that we don't have presidents and kings who are on our side, that everyone at the top is a piece of shit, whose mind has been rotted by Jewry and liberalism and all kinds of garbage. I do understand many things about us that have been stuffed up, including our natural resistance to enemies, which has itself been degraded by the presence of Jewry. We all would have lashed out at the Black Plague and many other plagues, including the Jewish plague, if it wasn't that Jewry knows how to suppress, let's call it, the European race's immune system. I want to show you some examples from the greatest of the modern Europeans, the Germans, the Nazis, what they thought of truly hopeless and desperate situations. What did men, white men, Germans in particular, who faced true danger, massive danger on an incredible scale, real danger, danger that could get you killed very quickly, and men who faced such dangers regularly, but they are of high intelligence and high courage? And how would they view situations which they considered to be hopeless? How would they look at that? That's what we're going to take a look at in this video. But make no mistake, facing truly, truly hopeless situations is a thing that has been done by Europeans all across our civilization many times. Not dozens of times, not hundreds of times, probably tens of thousands of times, maybe even more than that if you had to truly go into our history in ancient, ancient times. Our ancestors faced many dangers, and they weren't wussified dangers like the kinds of dangers we face or we imagine we are facing. They faced real dangers where maybe in the next day or two your town or city could be crushed by an enemy army that will then be running through the streets, killing you and destroying everything you have. Those are the kinds of dangers that our ancestors faced on many occasions. Take a look at the screen in front of you, and there you'll see a German general. His name is Heinz Guderian. We will still be discussing Heinz Guderian more in later videos in the not too distant future. But Heinz Guderian is a German general who was basically the inventor of tank tactics, of what has come to be known as the Blitzkrieg. And Guderian had a lot of contact with Hitler during World War II. And Hitler fired him, and then later Hitler brought him back, and Hitler actually said to him that he was right. And Hitler said to him, "You were right, and I didn't listen to you." And Hitler gave Heinz Guderian a special position. He made him the Inspector General of all tanks, all mobile forces, because Guderian is the creator of successful tank tactics. And even these days, if you look at wars that are raging elsewhere, whether it is in Iraq with the Americans and the British, or whether it is even the Ukraine war with the Russians and the Ukrainians, you will never again see the kind of successes that tanks had in the time of the Germans. In the time of the Germans, tanks were extremely successful. Before Heinz Guderian and the Nazis, and after Heinz Guderian and the Nazis, you will not see tanks being as potent as they were at the time that Guderian and Manstein and lots of the other German commanders, Hermann Bölk and lots of others, you'll never see tanks being as potent as they were back then. And that is maybe a topic that we might discuss in the future. But Guderian was responsible for a lot of the strange innovations that caused tanks to become awesome. When the British invented the tanks, and British were the original inventors of tanks, they never quite got tanks to being super successful. But it is Guderian who turned tanks into being something incredibly successful. So during World War II, Guderian commanded various armies, various panzer armies and groups, and he did a lot of fighting. And later, after Hitler fired him and Hitler brought him back, Hitler gave him special powers so that he could control all of the tanks across the entire German army, and that he could even give orders to other generals and other units to follow the rules and the principles that he came up with, and to do things the way that he said they should be done. And Guderian was there right through to the end of the war. Once Hitler brought him back, he stayed and he fought like crazy and did all he could right to the very end. Guderian was there from the beginning, whether it was in Poland, right to the last days of the war. And Guderian also had a nickname. They used to call him Hurrying Heinz. And Hurrying Heinz was constantly on the move. He was dashing around among his troops, meeting with them, checking what was going on, talking to them, moving on to see what the other lot is doing, and so forth. Heinz moved around a lot, saw a lot, and was at the front line most of the time. Right in the beginning of the war, in Poland, when the German troops were still inexperienced, Heinz Guderian saw that the German troops were just not performing and doing what they should, and that the Poles were actually giving them a hard time and even smacking them. And he ended up even driving in places where there weren't even other troops around to protect him. He was driving through dangerous places, etc., as he was checking out the situation, and then he'd come back and he'd start telling the troops, "Hey, you got to do this, you got to do that, go and attack over there," etc. The German generals in World War II, like the French generals in the time of Napoleon and the Romans and many other great armies that existed, those German generals moved around a lot, saw a lot, and they saw tons and tons of stuff in dangerous situations that are beyond the kind of danger that any of us could imagine. They lived through it and they saw it firsthand. They narrowly missed death on many occasions. So Heinz Guderian saw lots of stuff, lots and lots and lots of human behavior up front. And here is an interesting quote from Heinz Guderian. He says, "There are no desperate situations. There are only desperate people." So that's a kind of a strange quote, that thing. There are no desperate situations. There are only desperate people. What does he mean by that? And this puzzled me for quite a time. But if you look at it carefully, he's telling you that people can be feeling desperate. They are feeling desperate. They are feeling that the situation is out of control. But what is he telling you? He's telling you that despite them feeling desperate, that their situation is not desperate. So just look at this. He's saying there are no desperate situations. There are only desperate people. So you might feel that you are desperate. You might feel that your situation is hopeless, but actually it's not. You may feel desperate, but that doesn't mean that your situation is desperate. In other words, you're looking at a white man who's got an incredible amount of experience at dealing with every kind of situation imaginable, and he doesn't regard anything as being desperate. That no matter how bad you think it is, he is quite confident that there is a solution to your problem. It's just that you don't see the solution. The more I look at history, and the more I look at people, and the more I look at warfare, the more I see warfare as something that has a lot of good aspects to it. That warfare teaches you stuff. That warfare teaches you a level of skill that you will never find in the normal soft world. And this is especially true for men. This is utterly true for men. If I wanted to make a video about desperate situations for white men in warfare, I would probably be able to spend the rest of my life and probably an entire lifetime or six doing nothing but making videos about white men who faced desperate, super dangerous situations in warfare. There are so many situations that our ancestors have faced that you just won't believe it. But what you get from men who've been very experienced in warfare and in facing danger is you get a mindset where the mind becomes very practiced and the mind is very hardened and the mind is tough. It's almost like somebody who's a gym fanatic, and the gym fanatic has got hard muscles and he's in tip-top physical shape. His muscles are used to that level of hardship. But the difference is that in this case, the muscle that is used to this is a muscle sitting in your head. It's in your skull. And that muscle in your skull looks at everything and it finds solutions to all kinds of problems. That muscle is so practiced that there is nothing that scares it. And when you start studying warfare, which we're going to do a lot more of in the coming videos, you're going to start seeing this kind of stuff coming up again and again and again. You'll see the extreme mental agility, depth of thinking, hardness of mind, the ability of the mind to slice through problems like a hot knife through butter, that these kinds of minds are not freaked out by anything. There's nothing that scares them. It is a very specific type of thing that you'll find tons of in the history of the European people. You'll find tons of this stuff, where men have become so hardened and they are so sharp that for them there is nothing that can scare them. They are almost immune to fear, and facing death and being on the edge of death itself doesn't scare them, and they don't get panicked by anything. They'll face all situations. You are looking at the mind of a Superman. And we've had lots of supermen in our history. Whether it is a white man with a spear facing a mammoth, or whether it is men like these facing tanks, aircraft, vast amounts of artillery, and they are vastly outnumbered, but they are cool and calm, and they are ready to do their thing. Nothing freaks them out. This, to me, is the highest state of mind that a white man can acquire. Another final thing about Guderian, in the many operations and the many things that he had to do, especially in Russia, is that at a point, I'm not sure if it's Guderian himself, I think it was Guderian himself who commented like this. Guderian mentioned to someone else, he said, as you know, So many of my operations, my military operations, hang on a thread. And that concept that so many of his military operations hang on a thread is something that we'll return to. Because many of these tremendously great white minds operated under conditions where every other normal kind of white guy or any other person of any other race would look at this and would say, what you're about to do is impossible. You cannot do this because it's impossible. But these guys are so experienced, so knowledgeable, their depth of knowledge is so tremendous that they can regularly pull off feats that to anybody else would appear to be impossible. Then, of course, once they've done the impossible, sadly, in the annals of history, the vast majority of people then forget that most everything they did was almost impossible. And people then say, oh, well, it was to be expected, etc. And that's an unfortunate fact that occurs with a lot of people who look at history. And then they become bored with history, and then they don't understand the absolute genius of the people that you're actually studying. That these people had minds like computers, that these people were capable of doing on the battlefield that which you would be amazed if it was done by someone who was playing chess, or someone who was playing tennis, or someone who was playing football. If you saw, oh wow, check how that guy ran, look at how he passed that thing, and he just managed to pip that guy at the post and he won. If you could grasp that, if you could grasp the technical aspects of what this man is doing, you would say, good God, that was an amazing feat. And unfortunately, tons and tons of history, especially military history, is lost on people because people just sloppily go through the history books and they don't really look carefully and they don't truly grasp the actual problems that these men faced. But we're going to be doing more of that in videos to come in the not too distant future. I'll start showing you some actual examples where you will start seeing how brilliant some of these guys are, that these men are truly amazing. So a guy like Guderian was used to doing things that are so dodgy and so likely to fail, but 9 times out of 10, he will manage to pull it off and he'll succeed. Whereas anyone else of lesser talent, lesser skill, would have just failed outright. And if it had to be in the modern day and age where we've got equals like blacks and Jews and others, well, if you had to have those blacks and Jews come and look at the same problem, they would say to you, no, this is impossible. I've told the story before of times in my computer career where I would be talking to blacks who had all kinds of skills on paper. On paper, they had skills far beyond my skills. And then I would say to the black, well, can we do this and this and this? And the black would actually tell me straight out, that's impossible. So a black would tell me something is impossible, but what I don't tell the black is that the very thing that he's telling me is impossible is something that I've actually done several times before. And I just leave his ignorance there. So he tells me with absolute certainty, that thing that you're asking for, Jan, that's impossible. It's impossible to do. But I know it can be done because I have done it. So it isn't impossible. But maybe for him it is impossible because he's got a weak mind and he's an idiot. And so he cannot see the solution when I can see the solution. So think of these kinds of men in that kind of way, that if a black or a Jew had to look at the situation, that hold their hands up in the air in despair, and they'd say, that problem cannot be solved. But to a guy like Heinz Guderian, he'd look at it and he'd say, nah, no problem. I'll show you how it's really done. I did do a video about Napoleon where I said how to think like a genius. I did a video about Napoleon with that title where I pointed out how Napoleon would solve problems and how other Frenchmen acknowledged that they thought that situations were impossible, and then Napoleon turned around and said, well, if you go about it in this way, this way, and this way, then it's not impossible. And then they had to admit, yeah, it looked impossible to us until Napoleon showed us that it's not impossible. This is the rich wonder of our history and of the history of white men who have struggled. And this is what makes military history so amazing, is that you've got tons and tons of white men who have faced situations that are insanely difficult. And they get so used to this, and they get so used to problem solving and facing all kinds of incredible problems, that afterwards they become so practiced, like somebody who's going to gym all the time, lifting those weights and doing those exercises that to someone else would be impossible. So that'll give you a little bit of an idea of just one Superman, Heinz Guderian. But you get all kinds of white supermen in all kinds of situations. But I like the military stuff as well, because military has got one feature that you don't get anywhere else in life, and that is fear. Fear and extreme danger. So these guys not only have to solve problems, but if they make the slightest mistake, lots of other men could get killed. These guys could get killed themselves, and it's very dangerous. So warfare brings with it a level of danger and desperation that is unlike anything that you'll find anywhere else at all in life. And you'll be amazed how many white men become awesome at this kind of stuff. So there's Heinz Guderian, the man whose operations, many of his operations, hang on a thread. The chance of failure is very high, yet most of the time he pulls it off. And Guderian says there are no desperate situations. There are only desperate people. But it doesn't mean that your situation is desperate. You're just not thinking properly. And this comes from a man who lived through all kinds of insane hell. So you're not going to do better than somebody who's walked the walk and knows things that we may never have a chance to know. Now let's turn our attention to two other gentlemen. On the left is Hitler on the screen, and on the right is General von Manstein. Hitler, Manstein, and Guderian often dealt with each other. And Guderian had a lot of respect for Manstein. Guderian said that Manstein was their greatest strategic thinker, that there was nobody who could think strategically in a military sense better than Manstein. In this particular video, I'm focusing on military situations that are hopeless. But the truth of the matter is that with regard to Hitler, Hitler was a problem solver of note. Hitler solved problems in so many ways. Hitler solved military problems, and Hitler solved lots and lots of problems that were not military problems. He had a mind that was problem-solving like a freaking computer. And many of the problems that Hitler has solved, there are things that Hitler has done that have never been repeated. Whether it is the Hitler Youth, educating the youth, fixing the youth, preparing the youth for the future, that's in a category all of its own. Whether it is overcoming economic problems, coming up with a system that is superior to capitalism, Hitler stands in a class of his own. And Hitler's mind was always sharp. Nothing fazed him. He faced everything right to the end. And even some of the other guys who were with him, like old Goebbels. Old Goebbels wasn't a bad guy. I have a lot of respect for Goebbels. These were really great men and they were awesome. And so what you find around Hitler is you find all these men who have been hardened and their minds are super sharp, especially the minds of the generals. But even some of the non-military people, like guys like Albert Speer. Speer was a genius of organization. He's in a class of his own when it comes to other kinds of things that he could pull off. And Napoleon was surrounded by similar kinds of men. And it's actually amazing when you get a nation where you get a lot of these men and the best of the best comes out of them, and then they are there at the top and their minds are sharp and they are all extremely capable. And between them, the kinds of problems they can solve and the thoughts they can think, it's just astounding. And then, of course, these shitbags known as Jews run around the world and get the whole world to gang up on them and destroy them while screeching constantly, "Oh, these men are so evil, they're so evil." Meanwhile, it's a bunch of bullshit. These are great men capable of fantastic things, and if only they'd been left alone, this world would have been in a far, far better space now. We are surrounded by the Black Plague and the Jewish Plague because our best were killed, because the work of our finest was destroyed by the lower man, by these worthless sacks of screeching shit, also known as Jews. The cleverest men, the hardest men, the strongest men, the sharpest men ended up being destroyed simply through being massively outnumbered to a level that even they could not overcome. But just remember, a little nation the size of Texas almost defeated the whole world. Almost. It was very freaking close. And we are the poorer for it, so now we've got Black Plague and Jewish Plague and all kinds of other hideous, horrific things. Faggot plague and all kinds of other garbage. I want to turn your attention, therefore, to the writings of Manstein after World War II, when he wrote his memoirs, because Manstein wrote about Hitler and Stalingrad and hopeless situations. And just like all the others, there wasn't a situation that Manstein considered hopeless. Manstein did impossible stuff, and sometimes he even stretched the mind of Hitler. And that was because Manstein was extremely excellent militarily, to a point that sometimes unnerved even Hitler. And we will get to study some of the things that Manstein did. But I have done a video about Manstein and the role that he played in getting the Germans to defeat the French in 40 days. It wasn't as much a sign of French failure as it was a sign of German genius. The French were good, But it was just that in this particular case, the Germans were geniuses. They had genius thoughts, genius plans, and they pulled it off with absolute brilliance. It was the kind of feat that happens rarely in history. Probably the only similar things that had been done 140 years earlier by Napoleon. It's the kind of stuff that happens once in 100 or 150 years. That's how rare it is. It's not the kind of stuff that's done every day or every 10 years. This is excellence of excellence. Let me read from Manstein's memoirs a little section here that relates to the 11th Army. The 11th Army was Manstein's army in Crimea. And just listen to this. Let me read a paragraph. And he's writing about his own troops. And he says, "These men put up a tremendous performance in the period 1941-2, fighting one battle after another against an adversary who almost invariably outnumbered them. In attack and pursuit, their aggressive spirit was unparalleled, and when the situation appeared hopeless, they would stand and fight unflinchingly. Often they may not have known what compelled us, the commanders, to make demands on them that seemed impossible to fulfill, or why they were flung from one action to another and from one front to the next, and yet they went to the very limit of endurance to carry out these demands, reciprocating the trust of those who led them." So what Manstein is describing is his 11th Army and how his troops would be called upon and put under tremendous pressure, and they did everything they were told. And a very important thing in here, which I'll return to again, is the trust between the soldiers and their commanders. These soldiers are asked to do impossible things. They are pushed to the ends of their endurance and into desperate, desperate, deadly situations. And they trust their commanders and they do what they are told to do. And everybody is working together as a team, and that team trusts each other. The common soldier trusts and has total faith in his commander. It's a topic we'll return to. But it's just interesting that he mentions that his men, when the situation appeared hopeless, they would stand and fight unflinchingly. So no matter how desperate the situation seemed, the men had total faith in their commanders, and their commanders knew what they were doing. They were asking their men to do hard things, but the men understood, and the teamwork is unmatched. Jewish sacks of shit will try to break this stuff down, and the Jewish sacks of shit will tell you, "Oh, the Nazis were so cruel, the system was so evil, they had to do these evil things, and it was so terrible." No, you don't understand whites. You don't understand Europeans, that when our system works, and when our system works from the top to the bottom, everybody knows their place, and everybody gets together and works as an incredible team. And that's actually what's taking place here. So just be aware that the Jewish rat scum, they'll read this kind of stuff and they'll turn around, "Oh, it was so evil, so terrible, so dreadful." No, these white men are proud and they're happy and they know what they're doing and they know why they're doing it and they trust their commanders. Trust is something that Jews and blacks and a lot of other garbage don't know. They don't know how it really works. Our race does it. We've been doing it for ages. Manstein in his memoirs writes a lot about the 6th Army at Stalingrad. And Manstein even attempted to save the Sixth Army and came very close to doing so. It was yet another impossible mission, but in this case, the impossible mission failed, and I'm not going to deal with that at this point. It's not of great importance here. But it is a fascinating read how Manstein and other commanders made an incredible effort to save the Sixth Army. So what I want to read about are some comments from Manstein about Hitler and the Sixth Army and the situation there. So he's talking about the fact that the Russians called on the Sixth Army to surrender. And Manstein writes the following: On 9th January, the enemy called upon Sixth Army to capitulate. On Hitler's orders, the demand was rejected. I do not think I can be reproached with ever having taken an uncritical view of Hitler's decisions or actions in the military sphere. Yet I entirely support the decision he made in this instance, for however harsh it may have been from the humanitarian point of view, it was still necessary at the time. So what Manstein is commenting on is Manstein has criticized Hitler on various decisions that he made during the war. But Manstein says that he totally supports Hitler's stance on this particular instance, that when the Russians called on the Sixth Army to capitulate, Hitler said, "No, you mustn't surrender." And Manstein says that this is the correct thing to do. And then Manstein goes on to explain why he says this. He says, "I do not propose to deal here with the purely soldierly viewpoint that no army may capitulate so long as it still has any strength left to fight. To abandon it would mean the very end of soldiering. Until we reach the happy era when states can do without armed might, and soldiers no longer exist, this conception of soldierly honor will have to be maintained. Even the apparent hopelessness of a battle that can be avoided by capitulation does not in itself justify surrender." Now listen carefully to the next and final paragraph. Manstein writes, "If every commander-in-chief were to capitulate as soon as he considered his position hopeless, no one would ever win a war." Let me just reread that sentence to you. If every commander-in-chief were to capitulate as soon as he considered his position hopeless, no one would ever win a war. Even in situations apparently quite bereft of hope, it has often been possible to find a way out in the end. From General Paulus's point of view, at all events, it was his soldierly duty to refuse to capitulate. An exception could only have been made if the army had had no further role to play and could serve no useful purpose in prolonging its struggle. And this in turn brings us to the crucial point which justifies Hitler's order to refuse to capitulate, and also barred the army group from intervening in favor of such action at that particular time. No matter how futile Sixth Army's continued resistance might be in the long run, it still had, as long as it could conceivably go on fighting, a decisive role to fulfill in the overall strategic situation. It had to try to tie down the enemy forces opposing it for the longest possible space of time. I'll leave out the next paragraph because Manstein describes the fact that at the beginning of December there were 60 enemy formations that were surrounding Stalingrad, and that there were others coming in, and that the total enemy formations was actually growing to around 90 formations against the remnants of Stalingrad, of the 6th Army in Stalingrad. So he's describing that there are vast numbers of troops, and their numbers are growing more and more as they're surrounding the remnants of the 6th Army in Stalingrad. So the troops in Stalingrad are massively outnumbered, and their situation is utterly hopeless. And then Manstein says this: the army was still capable of fighting, even though this was ultimately futile from its own point of view. Yet its ability to hold out was of decisive importance for the situation on the southern wing. He's referring to the southern wing of the German army in Russia. He continues, every extra day, 6th Army could tie down the enemy forces surrounding it was vital as far as the fate of the entire Eastern Front was concerned. It is idle to point out today that we still lost the war in the end, and that its early termination would have spared us infinite misery. It is merely being wise after the event. In those days, it was by no means certain that Germany was bound to lose the war in the military sense. A military stalemate, which might in turn have led to a similar state of affairs in the political field, would have been entirely within the bounds of possibility if the situation on the southern wing of the German armies could in some way have been restored. This, however, depended first and foremost on 6th Army's continuing the struggle and holding down the enemy siege forces for as long as it possessed the slightest capacity to resist. It was the cruel necessity of war which compelled the supreme command to demand that one last sacrifice of the brave troops at Stalingrad. The fact that the selfsame supreme command was responsible for the army's plight is beside the point in this context. Let's return to those points that Manstein made, because I want to comment on them more. Manstein actually says that we lost the war, but in those days it was by no means certain that Germany was bound to lose the war. And he goes on to say that the war could still have been fought to a stalemate, etc., etc. Keep that stuff in mind, because this is a guy who was there and a guy who really was at the top of his game. And when you hear all this stuff after World War II about, oh, the Germans were this and the Germans were that and they were broken here and Stalingrad was a great failure for Hitler, when you read this stuff from Manstein, who's talking about it in the way of a white man whose mind is cold, hard, and calculating, he's not thinking emotionally, he's thinking like a machine. And this is one of our greatest strengths. So Manstein is saying that there was no reason to believe at that point in time that all was lost. There were many ways in which that situation could possibly have been fixed. So keep these things in mind when you hear all these commentaries, all these junk commentaries about how stupid Hitler was and how stupid the Germans were. That's not true. A very important point that comes out of these observations of Manstein, which is the kind of stuff that I think lots of men will miss when they are reading military history, they will miss the importance of this, is that Manstein says there that for the 6th Army to fight at that point in time was futile, that there was no way that the 6th Army was going to survive and that the 6th Army was going to defeat the Russians or get itself out of that situation that it was in. Yet he says that the 6th Army had to carry on fighting until it had no more strength left, which is exactly what happened. So you may wonder, why is he talking like this? Why is he supporting Hitler's order, don't surrender? And the reason is because 6th Army, despite its nasty position for itself, is still a tremendous asset for the rest of the Wehrmacht. And this is something that none of these other goofball modern commentators, idiots, point out, is that 6th Army is actually assisting the rest of the Wehrmacht out of all proportion to what is left of the 6th Army. That the 6th Army, by being undefeated and still fighting back, is still causing so much pain for the Russians that the Russians have to bring in even more troops and even more troops and even more troops. And this tiny remnant of 6th Army is actually sucking all these vast numbers of troops towards it and keeping them busy. And by doing so, it is reducing the pressure on the rest of the Wehrmacht. That by having 6th Army there as a kind of cancer that is sucking in the enemy, it is helping all of the rest of the Wehrmacht. Even though 6th Army itself will never be able to win, every day that 6th Army can tie down all those dozens and dozens of Russian formations is good. It's helping all the other soldiers. It's helping the entire war effort, actually. Keep this kind of stuff in mind, because people who don't study warfare don't realize that, you know what, even if I'm in a situation where I am in a futile position, but by me doing what I'm doing, I'm drawing the enemy away from someone else on our side. That is a valid way of thinking, and it's a very correct way of thinking. That if every soldier and every unit at every part of the battlefield pulls on the enemy and wears them down and ties them down to the maximum, it helps each other. That there is an interdependence between the troops. And one of the things that Manstein brings out in his memoirs is that it was a fantastic achievement of the 6th Army that it actually drew such a vast number of the Soviet resources onto itself, and that it helped the German army as a whole. And that in actual fact, that when the 6th Army collapses, that it releases a vast number of Soviet troops who are then going to attack the southern front. And there are so many of them that are now going to be free to attack the southern front that it's going to be a hell of a task for the southern front to hang in there and for the southern front as a whole not to collapse. And that is in fact where Manstein came in, and he saved the whole southern front. That's a topic we'll discuss later. But it is never mentioned by all these crybabies, goofballs, and Western non-German commentators that 6th Army was pulling off a very valuable task, actually, by holding them down in that city. And the story of Stalingrad is not really always just the story of, oh, it was a stupid thing to do and they all got killed and it was an idiotic idea from the beginning. No, Stalingrad was a place where they were able to suck them into this city and they battled like crazy to destroy the Sixth Army, and that actually the Sixth Army performed a fantastic feat that helped the rest of the army. And whites as a whole should keep these kinds of things in mind, that even though we live in different countries and we aren't able to help each other directly many times, that if we operate on a racial basis, even though we are far apart from each other, we can play a game that is very similar to that game by Sixth Army. We can help each other by drawing the enemy and taking care of things in our own space because ultimately we are interdependent too. There's a lot of really good thinking that comes out in military stuff, but because we've got this anti-military kind of mindset and this mindset of just running after money and that kind of thing, that we don't understand how military people think. And in this case, you'll see that Manstein was 100% on Hitler's side in this regard, that just because your situation looks bad, and just because you in your situation will never be able to come out of it and survive it yourself, doesn't mean that you must just quit, because you are part of something bigger. And you are actually doing something worthwhile, even in that totally futile situation that you're in. It may be futile for you, but you are actually helping the group, and the group is benefiting as a result. And we should be thinking like that about all our situations. That we must always remember that we are part of something bigger. The thing that we are part of is the European race. And we must each do our little bit. Even if we think our little bit is futile, we must do it. Then, as a general point, Manstein said that any army, must fight as long as it has the strength to fight. And that you mustn't just surrender because the battle appears to be hopeless. That if you did that would be the end of soldiering. Now, what he's really telling you is that there are so many situations that soldiers, and I'm talking trained, armed, professional soldiers fighting in real wars, heavy wars, there are so many situations where even those soldiers and those unit commanders are in, where they look at their situation and they're thinking, our situation is hopeless. We don't know how we're going to survive this. And Manstein is saying that as a soldier, you must fight. You must fight as much as you can while you can, and you mustn't just quit. And if you think that your situation is hopeless, and you just say, oh, well, my situation is hopeless, therefore I give up, he said that would be the end of soldiering. And so what he's kind of pointing out is that soldiering is itself a desperate enterprise where you don't really know whether you're going to win all the time. So if you're a crybaby and you look at your situation and say, oh, well, I'm screwed. We're screwed. And, you know, let's put on our weapons because we're screwed. That's not good enough. That is just not good enough. And that's not acceptable. You will fight until you cannot fight anymore, until maybe the enemy is standing right in front of you, sticking a weapon in your face and saying, I'm going to blow your brains out, you know. Then, okay, then maybe you then surrender. But Manstein is pointing out that soldiering is a hard job, and that even the soldiers and the unit commanders don't really always know whether they're going to win that particular fight. But you must fight the fight. And then he makes a very, very important statement. He says, if every commander-in-chief were to capitulate as soon as he considered his position hopeless, no one would ever win a war. So let me just take that apart carefully. He says, every commander-in-chief. So he's talking right up to the highest levels, the highest of the highest levels. So you're talking someone who's at a high level, who actually knows and has lots of information about the situation, and someone at a high level who's got much more information than someone at the low levels, like a soldier. And he's saying, even if a guy who's at the highest level looks at his situation and thinks that his position is hopeless, that in actual fact, what reality shows us is that many people think their situation is hopeless when in fact they've still gone on to win wars. That's really the bottom line of what he's saying, because he says, if every commander-in-chief were to capitulate as soon as he considered his position hopeless, no one would ever win a war. So he's telling you that even at the highest levels, a situation can look hopeless even to the people at the top. And they might think the situation is hopeless when in fact it's not really hopeless at all. So the common soldier will think it's hopeless. The commanders will think it's hopeless. Maybe even the guy at the very top may say, oh man, we're so screwed. But in actual fact, you don't know if you're screwed until you've actually fought on and tried to solve the problems and work out a way forward. And so what Manstein then says is this, where he says no one would ever win a war, and then he continues, even in situations apparently quite bereft of hope, it has often been possible to find a way out in the end. So let me repeat that. Even in situations apparently quite bereft of hope, in other words, totally hopeless, it has often been possible to find a way out in the end. So Manstein is saying to you, just because you think your situation is hopeless and by your judgment everything appears hopeless, you must fight on and you must try and solve problems, because in many situations that seem totally hopeless, you can actually find some kind of solution. You can find some way of surviving, some way of carrying on. So I'll repeat that. Even in situations apparently quite bereft of hope, it has often been possible to find a way out in the end. Let's go back to Guderian. There are no desperate situations, there are only desperate people. So here you have Manstein and Guderian, who are themselves masters of military stuff and extreme hardship. And they tell you, man, just because things are looking bad for you, even if you're a professional soldier, professional officer, a professional commander, and you think that your situation is hopeless, you don't dare put on your weapon. You fight your enemy, and you see whether your enemy actually is as strong as you think that they are. And I think that is a very deep lesson that comes out from these guys. These are not a bunch of goofballs, they're just making shit up. These are not like Jews, they just sit and dream all kinds of crap and write all kinds of shit down. These are men who've lived through incredible stuff, faced incredible situations, and they tell you, man, that you don't just quit just because it's looking impossible. You don't quit, and you don't quit, you don't give up. How dare you surrender if you've still got the ability to fight? How dare you do that? You shouldn't do that at all. Because your perceptions could be very wrong. You could assume all kinds of things about your enemy that is false. And by giving in to cowardice, By giving in to cowardice, you're actually losing your chance of victory. That's what he's telling you. And he's telling you that even in situations apparently quite bereft of hope, it has often, often been possible to find a way out in the end. So there's your feedback based on the proven experience of men who know what they are doing, men who've been through all kinds of stuff, is that just because you think everything is hopeless, how dare you think of quitting? Because quitting is bullshit. It's the way out of a coward, but as he says, no one would ever win a war if he just gave up whenever he thought he was in a situation that was impossible. He's telling you that don't let things like this, don't let your perceptions and your calculations make you want to quit, because you might be the one throwing away your chances of victory. You could win the battle, you could win the war, but your cowardice, your weakness is what's going to stop you from achieving something awesome. I have some wonderful examples of exactly this kind of stuff that the Romans faced. And that in and of itself is stuff for another day. And I want to show you some of the things that Julius Caesar and the Romans learned. And it boils down to exactly the same thing. And here you are learning from white men. White men who know their stuff, white men who faced extreme danger. Just because you think you're screwed doesn't mean you're screwed. Stand up, stand your ground, fight back. You might be in for a surprise. And you may well discover lots of things about yourself. And that's the beauty about these guys who've been in these wars and fought hard and done these kinds of things, is that they learned things about themselves. They improved their skills. They became sharper and sharper to the point where nothing scares them anymore. Nothing scares them anymore at all. Nothing. And this is the kind of thing that Hitler wanted people to be. He wanted people to be strong and be determined. And don't just let a bunch of Jewish and black crap and stuff scare you. Just because the enemy looks like they are this and looks like they are that, doesn't mean we're actually screwed. The experience of our race is that you don't quit. While you can fight, you do fight. And the only time you stop fighting is either when you're dead or when they're right on top of you and you realize, look, I gotta surrender or they're gonna kill me right here, right now. But you gotta fight as much as you can. Stand your ground and do like those troops of the 6th Army, do like those troops of the 11th Army. You fight like crazy, even when you think your situation is hopeless. What you don't know is how much pain you might be inflicting on the enemy. And that's an important thing to remember. Everyone sits and looks at things and says, oh, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to us? We're so fucked. We're so fucked. But you never sit and think, hey, the enemy is also afraid. Even those black goofballs who run around with their stuff, even these violent goofballs, you know what? They don't want to die either. I can assure you of that. They don't want to die and they don't want to bleed. And we must make it our business that when we are facing our enemies, that we must inflict the maximum pain and damage and hardship and mental strain and physical strain on our enemies to the maximum. And it is our duty, each and every one of us, inflict the maximum hurt and pain and anguish and stress on our enemies that we can, because by doing that, we are helping each other. And think of us as an army that stretches across the world, and that you might be, maybe you are or I am in a situation where my situation is maybe like the 6th Army, and we are the last dregs of the 6th Army, and maybe we won't be able to get out of our futile situation, but we have a duty for the others, that we are not going to let our enemy off the hook. For as long as we can, we must inflict pain, suffering, agony, anguish, etc. on the enemy and make their lives a living hell. The real goal of a soldier is to inflict the maximum pain on the enemy. Whether it's physical pain, mental pain, any kind of anguish that you can inflict on the enemy, you must do that. It is very important to do that. You are not there to love your enemy. You are there to put your enemy under so much strain that the enemy doesn't know their ass from their elbow. They don't know up from down, and they just want to break down and cry, and they just want to run away because we are giving them such a nightmare. That is the correct and proven way to deal with your enemies. This is what the European people have known for a long, long time. And keep these things in mind. Keep these things in mind, that we are here to assist each other, and it means that each one of us must knuckle down in our little corner of the world, and we must do what we can, because as a group we are interdependent like those armies, and we must help each other. And I can tell you that I am absolutely certain we can give our enemies so much pain that they won't know what to do. They'll run out of money looking for tablets and things to be able to make it through another day. We must make their lives such a hell that even if we don't inflict physical pain on them, we must drive them crazy mentally so that they run out of freaking money to buy tablets to calm themselves down. We must be making their lives such a misery that they queue in droves to go and see psychiatrists. With your enemy, the purpose is pain, suffering, anguish, every kind of unpleasantness that you can inflict on your enemy, you must. That is how we must treat all our racial enemies. That is the way that you face them. And if we all do that, I must tell you, I've looked at this Jewish house of cards, this global Jewish bullshit house of cards. I reckon we'll rip this thing down in no time at all. But it's very important to learn from these white men who are really experienced and who faced real life and death situations to insane degrees. And you get a chance to learn from such a depth of experience and such an incredible set of minds. Minds that are very, very super sharp, but also incredibly experienced. And when we become like that, if we can edge to becoming like that, and all white men need to really move down that path, we need to become more like that. Then I can tell you, our enemies are going to get clobbered. They're going to see that, hey, there are just a couple of whites around, but good God, can these white men inflict pain and suffering on them? And I must tell you, that is the proper way to deal with things properly. That is the way that has worked. It has worked for thousands of years. There are things like this that are absolutely necessary, and we must get away from all the softness and all this stupid thinking. There are times when the best way to deal with these damn people, these damn nuisances, damn hateful scum, is that we must make their lives a living hell. And that is the way you must think about it. And never let the stupid shit that Jews and liberals tell you about the futility of resistance and their need to surrender and to give up and how hopeless our situation is. Never, ever, ever listen to those sacks of shit, those worthless scum, garbage. Don't let their viewpoints and their psychological warfare get to you. Stick with our traditions. These traditions are tried and tested. They've worked for hundreds of generations. Men have learned the hard way that this is how you face life. Learn to behave like this. You are getting the benefit from hundreds of generations of clever, courageous men who dared to do this. And you'll see that everything will just repeat itself. I'm telling you, we can get back to the top. Easy peasy. It's easier than you think. All these goofballs and clowns who think that outnumbering the European men is going to be good enough to defeat us. Ha! Guess who's going to be dancing on their graves? It's us who are going to do some partying. After we've smashed them, crushed them, and we've won the next wars.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, you know you don't.